Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com. Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. Or, if you're listening on the Apple Podcasts app, you can subscribe within the app in just a few clicks. The year was 1975, and on British television, millions of viewers were about to discover the secret behind one of the greatest mysteries of all. Across the country, families watched open-mouthed with excitement as an intrepid band of investigators revealed the truth. Centuries earlier, an alien spaceship had crashed into the freezing waters of the Scottish Highlands, a spacecraft belonging to a shape-shifting race called the Zygons. And now, in the age of Gerald Ford, Leonid Brezhnev, Harold Wilson, and Karen Carpenter, the Zygons were preparing to unleash their ultimate weapon, a terrifying creature known as the Skarrison, or as we would call it, the Loch Ness Monster. So Tom Holland, that was Doctor Who, Terror of the Zygons, and let's be honest, it's no more implausible than some other explanations of the Loch Ness Monster.
And what did that description come from? Is it from a...
I read that myself.
Did you? In which book?
No, I read it just now.
Did you?
Do you not write bespoke introductions for episodes of The Rest is History?
No, normally I rip them out of books.
Well,
I'm very, very impressed. So you didn't write about this in any of your landmark histories of 1970s Britain?
Although I could have done, because actually what awakens the Skarrison and the Zygons in that Doctor Who story from 1975 is North Sea oil, is the efforts to get North Sea oil. So it's very, very timely.
Right. So, I mean, this takes us immediately to the point of what we're talking about today, which is obviously the Loch Ness Monster. And you may be wondering, why are we talking about the Loch Ness Monster in a history podcast? Because we are not cryptozoologists or anything along that line. Dominic, you're well known for your love of science and natural history.
Of course,
and all that
everybody
kind of
knows
stuff.
I love science.
But that very specific mid-70s context for the Loch Ness Monster shows, I think, why we're covering it.
It's a historical phenomenon, isn't it?
It is a historical phenomenon. So you didn't, because the 70s, when I was growing up, the Loch Ness Monster was a very, very vivid part of my mental imagination. And we'll come to why later on.
I wonder if you had the same Usborne book that I did, which was a book of mysteries that had the Loch Ness Monster, Bigfoot, the Yeti. All of, you know, and it's actually worth, these are interesting comparisons because they're very revealing about why people become interested at a particular moment in these kinds of phenomena.
Well, I did have that, but I also had another book, which was, and I can still, if I shut my eyes, I can visualize it absolutely. It was by a man called Tim Dinsdale, who again may reappear in our narrative. But on the cover, it was a purple, so it was a kind of twilight setting, the lock, Urquhart Castle, the famous ruined backdrop to so many illustrations of Loch Ness. And there was a kind of plesiosaur, so a long-necked aquatic reptile from the Mesozoic rearing up its neck. And I came across it just as I was emerging from my dinosaur obsession, but I so wanted it to be real. Wanted Nessie to be real. And I think lots of other people did, particularly in the 70s.
I think they did. They still do, I think, Tom.
And I think that sense of yearning, that sense of kind of desperation to believe that this had existed, I think is a really interesting...
But Tom, also, there are people who are very keen for it not to exist, not least members of the Scottish government who have recently been publishing advice. We shall come to this because they have very strong views about the popular culture of the Loch Ness Monster, don't they? And indeed have been encouraging Scottish schoolchildren to delve into this issue. Or have they? Well, we'll come to this.
Or have they? I'm not
sure.
Don't
tell me this is yet another bit of fake, rest is history, fake news. That would be terrible.
Well, the account I read was in the Daily Mail, and the Daily Mail, again, will play a very key part in this. So Britain's best
loved. So for those people who don't know, because I know we have a lot of Australians, a lot of Americans, Belgians, Danes, and so on who listen to this podcast. Tom, where is Loch Ness?
Okay, so what I would say, first of all, is that Loch Ness is not just a British phenomenon, that Loch Ness has a kind of global resonance. So we make no apologies for dealing with this this subject. And it has featured in large numbers of Hollywood films, all kinds of stuff. So the Loch Ness Monster is up there. You mentioned Bigfoot. You mentioned the Yeti. It's one of the kind of the big cryptozoids, I think they're called.
You're trying not to say the big beasts, aren't you?
The big beasts. The big beasts. So the backdrop to this, the setting of Loch Ness, it's the largest body of fresh water in Britain and Ireland. And it's basically very, very long and very, very thin.
Yes.
And if you imagine the map of Scotland, there is a kind of, it's called the Great Glen. It's this great kind of valley that goes roughly kind of about 45 degrees, doesn't it?
Yeah.
From the south up towards the north.
So it's from roughly Fort William to Inverness, isn't it?
Yes. And it's that the loch itself is, it's about a mile across. It's about 23, 24 miles long. And it's very, very deep. So at its deepest stretches, it's deeper than the North Sea is between Scotland and Norway. And it's very, very cloudy. So very, very difficult to see what lurks beneath the depths, which is also obviously very important. And for a long, long time, it was very, very isolated. The road that most people go along where Urquhart Castle features is on the western side. And the terrain along the eastern side is much harder to negotiate. There is now a road. And again, we'll perhaps talk about how the road comes to be there. But basically, it's a very deep, very long, relatively speaking, certainly by British standards, isolated stretch of water. And that really is the context, that Britain is a very crowded island. So the likelihood that there would be an unknown monster anywhere
Surrey.
In Britain is, yeah. Well, the Surrey Puma, of course. There were sightings of pumas in Surrey. Again, it was never tracked down.
Beast of Bodmin. If you remember the Beast of Bodmin. But monsters are more plausible, aren't they? The further you are away from the great kind of southeastern metropolis.
Well, so if you think of the other one, the Yeti is in the Himalayas. They're very isolated. Bigfoot is, Sasquatch is kind of the forests of Northwest America.
Yeah.
So again, very isolated. I know the Highlands are quite remote, but they're still they're not that remote. So it's extraordinary that the monster comes to have this purchase. It does. And I suppose the question that asks is why? And perhaps the best way to look at that is we've got a question from Tom Boat History Golding. Roughly what date is the first recorded mention of a monster in Loch Ness?
Well, you have the answer to this, don't you? It's pure Tom Holland territory, this.
Well, it's provided. The answer was provided on Twitter by none other than the great Fergal Sharkey.
So who's that, Tom?
Lead singer of the Undertones. And, of course, the Lorax. People in Britain will know him as the Lorax of the chalk streams. He's been leading a campaign against the despoliation of our chalk streams by predatory water companies.
He's one of your walking pals, isn't he?
He took me for a walk along the River Ver, which is a river that gave its name to Verulaneum.
All right, let's get back to Loch Ness.
Let's get back to Loch Ness. Yeah, sorry.
First mention of the Loch Ness monster, Tom?
Well, as I was saying, Fergal gave us the answer to this. And so he said that he was answering on August the 23rd. And he said that yesterday, so in other words, August 22nd, was the 1457th anniversary of the first sighting of Nessie by St. Columba, a famous Irish monk.
What's this, the year 565 we're talking
565,
about?
565. So that is supposedly the first dating of a monster in Loch Ness. And St. Columba, are you au fait with St. Columba?
I think about St. Columba most days, Tom. But just remind me who he was.
Well, he's an
I know, obviously, but remind
me. Of course you do. He is an absolutely, he's a top early medieval saint. He's from Ireland. Columba means the dove. In Irish, he's called Colum Killer. I hope I pronounced that right. Any Irish listeners, let me know if I haven't. Means the dove of the church. And he, like so many of these kind of holy men from Ireland, is of an aristocratic background, who then gives it up to lead a highly ascetic life. And it's that kind of process of self-abnegation that gives him his sense of power. But he brilliantly, according to tradition, that it, again, is, as you say, one of those rest is history facts that isn't a fact. But he gets into trouble because he gets embroiled in the first ever battle fought over copyright. So there's a Welsh saint called Saint Finian who has a psalter, and Columba borrows the psalter and makes a copy of it, and then says that he wants to keep the copy of it. And Finian says that he should have it back because he owns the original psalter, and therefore every copy properly belongs to him. And so they take it to the High King of Ireland, who says, to every cow belongs her calf, therefore to every book belongs its copy. So in other words, that, you know, he's not a fan of bookselling.
No, Irish copyright law is very restrictive.
Very, very restrictive. And Columba is very cross about this because he has to hand the copy of the Psalter over. And so he gets all his extensive and very, very well-armed family to raise a rebellion against the king. And there's a big battle. So it's the first battle over a copyright issue. Yeah. And Columba basically... It's not looking, you know, if you're a holy man, this isn't the kind of behavior that you want. So he leaves Ireland. So this is a story that's very, very late, written about 1,000 years after Columba lived. But I think it does draw on a tradition that perhaps Columba's aristocratic background leads to him being embroiled in dynastic politics in Ireland in a way that is incommensurate with his status as a man of the church. And also, as you may remember when we talked about Patrick, it's a big Irish thing among the saints that you go into a kind of exile, that you go on a pilgrimage abroad. So St. Brendan going off to discover America is one. St. Columbanus going to the continent is another. And Columba, he just pops across the sea to Scotland, and he gets given the island of Iona. And it's from Iona that he then goes up the Great Glen, along Loch Ness, up towards Fortriu, which people who listened to our episode on Macbeth may remember. It's kind of Pictish kingdom around where Inverness is. So that kind of area of Scotland. And the Pictish king is called Bride. And he's very interested in what Columba has to say. He doesn't convert to Christianity, but he allows Columba to come in. And Columba has various bust up with the Druids who are hanging around with Bride. But the other thing that he has a bust up with is a mysterious monster that inhabits Loch Ness. And the story is, and this comes from an account of Columba's life that was written about a century after he did this. So 565, he's crossing the River Ness, and he sees this person being buried, and he asks, you know, what's been going on? And the people who are burying this body say that the man had been swimming, that he'd been seized, and that he had been most savagely devoured by a water beast. And some people go out, they try and beat the monster off. Too late, the guy is dead, but they manage to get the body back out of the monster's jaws, and they bring him back, and they're burying him. So Columba, hearing this, decides something needs to be done. And so he tells one of his followers to go out and get a boat that is floating out in the loch. And one of his followers does this, goes out, but the sea monster, the monster is still hungry. So comes hurtling towards the man who's swimming out, and he's screaming and saying, "Ah, I'm about to be eaten." But Columba makes the sign of the cross, and
I'm reading it here. Yeah. "You will go no further. Do not touch the man. Turn back speedily." He said it in that voice, Tom.
He said it exactly like that.
So the beast does go back, as if pulled back by ropes, it says here. I'm just reading the saint's life. And the guy, you know, everybody's delighted and they say, "Hurrah, hurrah." And these people, crucially, are pagans, aren't they? So they see this and they say, "Columba must have access to this tremendous heavenly power. Isn't this splendid? Hurrah for God and Jesus Christ."
Pretty much, yes. And this is in the context of, we talked about Tolkien last week. So we talked about Beowulf, Beowulf's mother. Yep. is a fearsome monster who inhabits a watery domain. So that sense of lakes and lochs as being places where the spawn of Cain might live, monsters bred of the first murderer, is a tradition that is not just Germanic, but clearly part of...
Yeah. Well, here's my question for you, Tom. As you're a man, I mean, if there's anybody I know who enjoys saints' lives, medieval saints' lives, you are that man. This would strike me as a absolutely classic saints' life formulaic device rather than a genuine zoological, topographical description. Well, so in other words, if you read saints' lives, beasts are always lurking in rivers. The saint is using his powers to sort of cast them out or whatever. I mean, especially, you know, this, what is this, 6th century? I mean, this is an age when people are writing saints' lives, they always follow set formulae, and there's absolutely, surely no reason to believe that St. Columba genuinely confronted a creature of this kind in the River Ness.
I'm not sure about that. I mean, I don't think he did confront the Loch Ness Monster, because I don't think the Loch Ness Monster existed. But maybe some things that make it more specific. I don't actually think that saints go around confronting aquatic monsters all that much. I mean, Cuthbert doesn't do it. Aidan doesn't do it. All these other saints don't tend to do it.
I bet you I can find examples of saints who confront malevolent amphibians.
But if we're comparing it to Beowulf, I mean, it's more a kind of heroic thing. It's kind of a warrior thing. And it may be, maybe it's a reflection of the fact that Columba is of warrior stock, perhaps.
Yeah.
So we may, I don't know. But just one thing to throw into the mix is that the Picts famously didn't write. So we have no writings by the Picts. But they were very, very keen on sculpting. So absolutely wonderful sculptures. And they were very keen on sculpting animals. And all the animals are instantly recognizable. But there's one aberration, one animal that doesn't seem to be anything recognizable at all. And it's this kind of strange beast with, it's either a very long snout or a beak, something, so a bit like a kind of crocodile's jaws and flippers. So maybe that's what inspired the story. I'm slightly clutching at straws there. But
am I not right in saying, though, Tom, that, okay, so St. Columba has this confrontation with this beast, but then it kind of goes quiet. I mean, in the 10th century, in the 12th century, people aren't saying, gosh, remember there's that monster up at Loch Ness. I mean, no one is talking about the Loch Ness monster at all.
So I'm quoting here from an excellent book that was written 7 years ago by Gareth Williams, A Monstrous Commotion, The Mysteries of Loch Ness, which goes through the history of all these sightings. And he quotes a reference in 1520, a chronicler saying that the monster of Loch Ness is still unkilled, which is very, intriguing.
Could be a person. Could be a bandit captain or something, though.
Couldn't it? I mean, it could be. Yes, it could be.
Or a wolf or you know, some horrible bear. Do they have bears? I mean, maybe they didn't. But, you know, that doesn't mean... That's pretty vague.
It is. It is. Your searching skepticism is yet again puncturing the balloons of hope. Oh. But I think it reflects the fact that, as we said, that Loch Ness is very, very remote and isolated. And that, again, of course, going back to Columba, is a key part of it. Because the whole thing about saints is that they go to very remote places. That's the mark of a holy man, whether it's a desert or whatever. So in a sense, going to the shores of a remote loch is part of that tradition. And basically, people are not going there until the 18th century.
Yes.
So we mentioned how it's the western side that is much more easily approachable. The eastern side, very, very hard to get along because of kind of sheer cliffs and everything. And the guy who changes that is a man whose name must forever live in infamy, General Wade.
Well, I think you're being a bit harsh on General Wade. Yes, because General Wade is an 18th century general, isn't he? And he's tasked with building these military roads in the aftermath of the Union of England and Scotland. There's been a Jacobite uprising, and the Hanoverians are very keen to bring Scotland, to bring the north of Scotland into the sort of the orbit of the newly formed Union. And military roads are to enable, you know, people to march quickly if there's another Jacobite rising or something. So I guess, you know, is General Wade badly regarded in Scotland to this day, Tom?
Yeah, so General, so Wade basically creates the infrastructure in the Highlands, and he joins up all these forts that have been built to essentially kind of keep control of the Highlands. He builds a lot of roads, and one of the roads that he builds, kind of blasting out, you know, cliffs and so on, so that he can construct this path, is along the eastern side of Loch Ness. And I guess if you're a Jacobite, you're not very keen on this. But I think if you're wanting to get from, you know, one side of Scotland to the other, then it's great. So there's this famous verse written about him. If you had seen this road before it was made, you would lift up your hands and bless General Wade.
Is that by some sort of McGonagall figure?
Robert Burns. I don't think so.
No.
And so he's building his roads. He also recruits lots of Highland regiments. And basically these become the Black Watch. So this is a time when the Highlanders are seen by the military, you know, the British military authorities as a threat. But Wade is the guy who starts saying, well, actually, they're such good fighters. Maybe we can get them into the British Army. So he's starting that. But then the reason why his name is to forever live in infamy is that Bonnie Prince Charlie's uprising happens.
Yeah.
And Wade is in Newcastle, and Bonnie Prince Charlie goes on the other side. So he goes past Carlisle and gets all the way down to Derby before doing his retreat, going back to Culloden and so on, and escaping disguised as a French maid. Wade is so annoyed about this, the fact that he was unable to get from Newcastle over to Carlisle, that he decides to build another road linking Newcastle to Carlisle. And he's in such a hurry that he looks around for convenient stone that could serve him as the foundations for this military road. And what do you think the convenient stone is that he uses?
Don't tell me he built a road out of Hadrian's Wall.
He does. So General Wade is the guy who basically destroys Hadrian's Wall. And the reason why the only stretches of Hadrian's Wall that survive are in areas where, you know, rugged cliffs and so on, is because General Wade didn't want to go there.
Still, I bet he got a bloody good road out of it, I imagine.
Yeah, fine. So that's why not a fan. Not a fan. Anyway, so Wade builds this road, and it's known as Wade's Road. And that opens up, you know, people can now start going down Loch Ness on both sides. And basically, it's from this point on that you start to get kind of mentioned. So there are people, there are workmen who, as they're building the road, who report seeing two leviathans, so two giant creatures, and they think they might be whales. Then through the 19th century, occasional reports, but I mean, these reports are nothing, you know, they're insubstantial will-o'-the-wisp reports of exactly
they're
the kind that
fragmentary,
you would get,
aren't they?
Yeah, all over the place.
People who've actually probably seen a big fish, a seal, a wave.
A wave, a boat.
They're, you know, it's a stormy day and they're drunk or they're just romantically inclined and they think they've seen something. Gosh, we saw something in the water. And probably their account of seeing something would be utterly lost and forgotten were it not for the fact that people started looking back and sort of delving through the archives to find every fleeting reference.
Yes, but I think also it's a bit like, you know, a snowball going down a mountainside that it picks up velocity as it gathers weight. So 1888, there is a guy who's clearly been drinking too much whiskey who claims to have seen a monster like a large salamander. So that makes it into the newspaper.
I mean, a salamander, that's not...
that's like a Zygon, isn't it?
Yeah, that's not the conventional image of the Loch Ness Monster, is it? A salamander?
No, it's not. By the end of the 19th century, it's become sufficiently well known that people in America are, you know, in newspapers can write about it, about there being a monster in Loch Ness. And it's kind of part of the Highland mythology. But
it's the romantic evocation, I guess, of the Highlands as a wilderness.
But I would guess no more than, say, you know, the story of black dogs in Norfolk or something like that. It's if you're interested in folklore, perhaps you're aware of it, but most people, it's barely intruding. And then that changes with the 30s. And in the 30s, I think you could legitimately talk about Nessie mania.
So before we get to the 30s, Tom, can I just interrupt you a second? Because Am I not right in thinking that the top necromancer, Aleister Crowley, he was involved with Loch Ness in some way? So for those people who don't know, he lived at the kind of turn of the 20th century. He was sort of Mr. Black Magic, the occult. He was the guy who, in many ways, popularized the occult. And I'm very happy to say, Tom, he's the third person in recent months to have appeared on this podcast who went to my old school.
Did he? So, Aleister Crowley went to your school?
He did. So he joins James Jesus Angleton, demented CIA counterintelligence chief, and top wardrobe purveyor C.S. Lewis.
Yes.
As fellow old Malvernians like me. So but they went there
God, imagine C.S. Lewis and Aleister Crowley together.
They must have been, I think they were different generations, to be fair.
They weren't in the same rugger team.
No, they didn't share a dorm. So Aleister Crowley, he lived near the lock, didn't he? He wore a kilt and sort of pretended to be a laird.
Yes.
But didn't he put up signs, what I'm seeing from your notes, he put up signs warning people about the Colu Maverick, who he basically invented a monster to keep people off his land.
We didn't even say it was a monster. He never said what this Colu Maverick was. He just put the signs up and people became so terrified of him that they wouldn't go on his land. So it obviously worked.
He claims that he invented the Loch Ness Monster, does he?
Well, he did subsequently. But this is drawing on the reputation that he was already getting as a man of deep wickedness who summoned up demons and devils and so on. So I think, I don't think that once the Loch Ness Monster's become famous, then Crowley comes in and says, yes, it was all me. But I don't think that is part of what's feeding into it. And so the question of what does feed into it therefore becomes incredibly interesting. And I think that what we should do, I think we should take a break now. And I think when we come back, we should look at what happened in the 30s, Nessie Mania, why it might have happened, and then the kind of the aftershocks of that.
I hope I'm not going to spoil it for people when I say that I believe one of the world's finest newspapers may well have been involved. Am I right, Tom?
You are right.
Cool. Join us to find which paper after the break.
Which could it be?
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to The Rest is History. Now, very excitingly, top zoological pioneer, explorer, researcher Tom Holland is poised to solve the mystery of the Loch Ness Monster.
No, I'm not.
So, Tom, we've reached the 19... yeah, you are. We've reached the 1930s. You claim that it's all... the 1930s has the key to the mystery.
Well, it's 1933, specifically.
Yes, okay.
Everything kicks off in 1933, and you get this cascading sequence of sightings of the monster. And what's interesting is the way that the kind of the various elements of it become more and more recognizable to us. So in a sense, the kind of the image of the monster that we all have, slow, you can see it kind of coalescing in front of you when you look at all these various reports. So the first one is a woman called Aldi Mackay, who is driving with her husband down the Castle Urquhart side.
And this the gets western reported, side, yeah.
And the western side. And this gets reported by the local, the Courier in Inverness. And this is how the Inverness Courier reports it. So quoting Aldi Mackay, "The creature disported itself, rolling and plunging for fully a minute, its body resembling that of a whale and the water cascading and churning like a simmering cauldron. Soon, however, it disappeared in a boiling mass of foam. Both onlookers confessed that there was something uncanny about the whole thing, for they realized that here was no ordinary denizen of the depths, because apart from its enormous size, the beast, in taking the final plunge, sent out waves that were big enough to have been caused by a passing steamer."
Wow.
Which perhaps begs the question of whether whether it was caused by a passing steamer.
Yeah, I think the passing steamer reference there is disturbing to me, to be honest.
Yes.
So people are steaming on the lock at this point, Tom, are they? They are. The lock is becoming a place of pleasure.
I suppose so. I'm not entirely au fait
with Loch Ness, the history of the tourist board of
yeah, but it's not, but Dominic, it's not necessarily, not necessarily tourists. So because there's not, you know, there's the story of the monster hasn't got any currency, and there's not a lot else to see apart from a large expanse of water. But you have people who can basically be trusted because they are either sort of the earth watermen, people who are familiar with the waters. So there's a water bailiff called right. Alex Campbell, who over the course of the summer, we'll come to him in a minute, sees he introduces a crucial element to the story. But before that, you also have more motorists. And again, it's all about motorists going down the line of the lock. And these are two English tourists, George Spicer and his wife. And what's interesting about them is that they don't see it in the lock. They see it crossing the road in front of them.
I mean, the description is terrifying. They're driving along the road, aren't they? July 1933. So they're clearly on their summer holiday. And they see a large creature, 25 feet long. Yeah. I mean,
a long, wavy, narrow neck, slightly thicker than an elephant's trunk. George Spicer describes it as the nearest approach to a dragon or prehistoric animal that I have ever seen in my life, which may be saying nothing because presumably he'd never seen a dragon or a prehistoric animal.
He says it had an animal. It had an animal in its mouth and a body that's fairly big with a high back, webbed feet. He can't say if it had a tail because it moved so rapidly. When we got to the spot, it had probably disappeared into the lock. And actually, when you read up on them, they don't sound like fraudsters, Mr. and Mrs. George Spicer from Golders Green, because he works at a gentleman's tailor's in the West End. He's the director.
And so that again, you know, this seems a reputable witness, a gentleman's tailor. He's not going to be lying, is he?
But you can't trust a gentleman's tailor. So this is really the, of all the descriptions of the monster, this is probably the most important, would you say, Tom? Because it's the one that really establishes the...
Well, it blends with Alex Campbell, the water bailiff, because it's Alex Campbell. He describes seeing a monster with a long wavy neck. And it's Alex Campbell who first suggests that it is like a plesiosaur. And the plesiosaur is the long necked Jurassic creature, with the flippers.
But George Spicer is unusual. I mean, it's worth emphasizing this point. His description is so unusual because he describes the monster not in the water. So the monster is wandering along the road.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
A description that has never been repeated. So nobody else has ever seen the monster trudging around on the A roads.
But he does say that you can't see its legs. So the opportunity for it actually to have flippers and perhaps it's hauling itself out of the ground, you know, out of the water is still there. So this description gets taken to a naturalist who says that that it was almost certainly an otter.
must have been an enormous otter, 25 feet long.
Right. So this is what Mr. Spicer's reply, that the creature he had seen was far too big to be an otter, And Spicer goes on to say it should definitely be killed.
Yeah, that's the British spirit, the English spirit, isn't it?
Shoot it.
So this kickstarts a huge amount of interest, doesn't it, in the press?
Well, of course.
Because people presumably believe Mr. Spicer is telling the truth.
Yes. So you've got this reputable gentleman's tailor from London, and you've got this water bailiff who is, you know, the gilly, that kind of salt of the earth figure from a John Buchan novel, all that kind of thing. Again, absolutely trustworthy. And the pair of them, their evidence combines to imply that there is this creature with a very long, curvy neck. And it's Campbell who says, this is a plesiosaur. And that's what then really kickstarts it, because it's not just a monster, but it's a scientific monster.
Yeah.
So it could be a kind of prehistoric hangover. And that's really, I think, what gets people excited. And so from then on, you start to get this cascade effect. So in November 1933, you get the first photograph, or at least alleged photograph.
A photograph by a man called Hugh Gray. And I see from your notes, it says, a photograph that's actually believed to be of his own dog getting a stick from the lock. So, I mean, I hope if there are Loch Ness Monster enthusiasts listening to this who are dismayed by my skepticism, I have to warn you, there is more skepticism to come.
Yes.
But yeah, so that photograph is not definitive evidence, I think it's fair to say, Tom.
And then what hots up is that you start to get eccentric figures coming up. The kind of the image of the big game hunter, or the kind of Professor Challenger figure from the Conan Doyle stories. So the first monster hunter is a man called Commander Rupert Gould, who, as his title implies, had been in the Navy. He was very kind of eccentric man who loved going down rabbit holes to some effect, because he is the man who discovered John Harrison's chronometers, which are, you know, the latitude guy.
Okay.
And he'd found these chronometers kind of buried away in the National Maritime Museum in Greenwich. And he'd got them out.
I mean, finding some chronometers in a museum is not the same as finding a monster in a lock.
It's not. But, you know, these chronometers are a big deal. And they've been ignored. And he's dusted them down and he's produced them. So he has this
I'll tell you now, we're not doing a podcast about the chronometers.
I know we're not. But he is also... when he's not mending chronometers, he's obsessed by the idea of sea monsters, the idea that there are long-necked creatures out in the ocean. But he's the obvious person to turn to with the idea that maybe it's, you know, it's actually in this lock. And he gets funding from a guy who is, he's the heir to, I think it's Dundee Marmalade, which is the most popular.
Very big marmalade.
Yeah. Big marmalade in 1930s Britain. A guy called Alexander Keeler, who is has nymphomaniac qualities. He's a sex addict. And so when he's not being a sex addict, he's funding Commander Rupert Gould to go after the Loch Ness Monster. However, Rupert Gould is not the only hunter. And this, Dominic, is where Britain's best loved newspaper comes in.
Well, just before we come to Britain's best loved newspaper, I just want to put forward a theory, which is, of course, we're in the 1930s, so the world has been mapped, and the days of Victorian explorers are kind of over, aren't they? I mean, even the poles have been conquered. So the obsession with creatures of the deep, I mean, this is a generation that has actually, you mentioned Professor Challenger. These are now people who've grown up reading Conan Doyle's The Lost World, I suppose, aren't they? And they, you know, there are no more worlds to conquer other than the deeps. And so if you fantasize about lost kingdoms or you know, surviving dinosaurs, the oceans are really the only place to look, I suppose. Do you think, Tom?
I think that's absolutely true. Well, let's look at this further when we've described the next character who turns up.
So you mentioned the newspapers. And the newspaper in question is the Daily Mail. So for people, I know we have a lot of overseas listeners. So that's basically the British equivalent of Le Monde or El País, newspaper record, I think people call it.
That's not entirely true. is there an equivalent of the Daily Mail in other countries? I'm not sure.
I think these days it's actually the Daily Mail. I mean,
it's much detested by people on the left. Much written for by people like Dominic. Well, would it be fair to say?
Well, the Daily Mail is enormous in the popular culture of the early 20th century. So it's founded in the 1890s by Alfred Harmsworth. And it is sort of attention-grabbing journalism. And what the Daily Mail does a lot in the 1920s and 30s is stunts and wheezes. So they're always sending people to discover things, or they're investigating mysteries, or they're inventing hats, or they're sponsoring, you know, the first British radio broadcast, Nellie Melba on the top of a department store. So they're always doing these kind of, they've constantly got gimmicks, I guess.
Yeah.
And this maintains their audience. I mean, their core audience, which is a sort of populist audience, sort of lower middle class, ordinary people who can't be bothered to read the Times, which is also owned by the same newspaper baron at one point. They don't want to wade through sort of turgid prose, sort of column after column of it. They want fun and they want sensation.
This is before television. So it's a kind of, it's the closest you get to, I guess, a kind of documentary about aliens on the History Channel or something like that.
Right.
That's basically what's going on here, because they see, the editorial team see the photograph that may be of this dog, but is being marketed as the photograph of a monster. And so they decide that they want proof and they want to blazon it over the front page of the newspaper. And so this is the first intrusion of the London press into the story. So up to now, it's all been local newspapers, particularly based in Inverness. And so suddenly the London press are turning its attention to Loch Ness, and they employ, even as Commander Gould is out on his boat hunting for the monster, they employ an extraordinary figure called Marmaduke Wetherall.
You couldn't make him up, because he's great.
No. So he's an actor, but he's also a big game hunter.
Do you know what he'd performed in? He'd played both David Livingstone and Robinson Crusoe in films he'd directed and written himself.
Yeah.
That's the kind of man we're dealing with.
Absolutely. And that sense that he's an actor who's kind of played people who've been into Africa on great quests, like David Livingstone. But he's also a big game hunter who's been to Africa on quests, is absolutely kind of redolent of that mood in the early 30s, I think, isn't it? Of the way in which the kind of the traditions of Victorian derring do and imperial adventuring are starting to cannibalize themselves. Because actually, you know, there's not much of the world left unexplored. And so if you're going to have thrills and spills and explorers, you need to start migrating to film, you know, Lost Valleys of the Amazon or whatever. Yes. And there's obviously a very obvious cinematic example of this that we'll come to when we've finished our roundup of all the sightings.
But of course, Wetherill cannot afford to come back and say, it's all hokum, can he? I mean, it's both in the Daily Mail's interests, but crucially in his interests, that he, this sort of bearded, you know, this sort of Professor Challenger figure, as you say, the Arthur Conan Doyle character, he absolutely needs to come back with something. And for 2 days, he finds nothing. And then on the third day, Tom, what happens?
So on the third day, he's on the kind of the really wild eastern side, the General Wade's Road side, which is mainly rock, so very little mud. But he comes across a very short patch of mud. And there, remarkably, are some stunning prints. And they're 8 inches across, and they've got four short clawed toes, and they look a little bit like a hippopotamus, but obviously it can't be a hippopotamus because you don't get hippopotamuses in Loch Ness monsters. And nearby are another set of prints. And this is obviously a massive stroke of luck, because it seems that the monster, if it is the monster, has walked across one of the very few stretches where the imprint of its footprints would be left.
What are the chances?
So incredible. And so, Wetherall wires back to the Daily Mail, have found the monster, and the Mail clears its headlines. Monster of Loch Ness is not a legend, but a fact.
Well, that's the kind of understated headline you would absolutely expect.
So huge excitement. And only once they've run the headline do they then send the prints to the Natural History Museum in London to see if they can identify it. And they
say
the
Natural History Museum say?
They say that it is not the impression of any known aquatic mammal in the British Isles. But they continued to do the research. And in the new year, so early 1934, they reveal that it is in fact a hippopotamus footprint. And it's a single footprint. So in other words, it's a single footprint of a hippopotamus that has been pressed down into the mud over and over again to make it look like there are multiple footprints. And they suggest, the Natural History Museum suggests that it's a hunting trophy, a hippopotamus foot that's been converted into an umbrella stand, which is very much the kind of thing that...
That's such a 1930s story.
1930s. You kill a hippopotamus and you turn one of its legs into an umbrella stand.
So I think this is a story that speaks very well of Marmaduke Wetherill, actually, because he is a man who clearly had the foresight to travel to Scotland with a hippopotamus foot umbrella stand in his luggage, just in case.
Just in case.
Because go on.
Well, I think more probably it wasn't him. It was someone else who did it.
Who was making fun of him.
He was looking. I think so.
Yeah.
Because as we will find out, Wetherill is unbelievably upset by this. And he's particularly upset by the fact that the male, rather than standing by their man in his hour of need, turn on him and call him an idiot and mock him roundly for his incompetence. And again, goes all over the front page.
I can't believe they would have done something like that, Tom.
shocking behaviour and very unlike anything you get from it now. So so Wetherill is left very, very embittered and with a big grudge against the male and against everybody involved in the search for Nessie. So he withdraws, licking his wounds. But over the course of 1934, more and more extraordinary developments happen. So, and again, you get people, the witnesses who cut through are witnesses who everyone can recognize as being reputable and reliable.
Yeah.
So early in January, you have a veterinary student on a motorbike who almost runs into the monster. So Dominic, that's another one where the monster is out and about, rolling around.
Odd that it doesn't happen so much these days, but there you go.
And the veterinary student again says that it looks exactly like a plesiosaur.
So,
and then in April,
the evidence is stacking up.
In April, you get probably the key piece of evidence, and it's in the form of a photograph, and it's a much better photograph than the photograph that looks like a dog's head. And in fact, I would go so far as to say it's one of the most famous photographs of the 20th century.
It's the photograph
anything,
that everybody's seen.
Yeah,
this podcast with.
Yeah. So it's. It looks like a plesiosaur. That's how you would describe it. It's a long neck creature with a hint of back, and there are kind of ripples around it, black and white. And you would know it if you've seen it.
Yes.
And this is known as the surgeon's photo. And it was taken in April 1934. And it's called the surgeon's photo because the person who took it was both a surgeon, but didn't want to be named. And again, this reticence was seen as something that suggested that, you know, the accuracy of it, because he clearly
wasn't after publicity.
And it turns out, so the surgeon is a man called Robert Wilson, who's a gynecologist, has rooms off Harley Street. And the whole, I mean, again, this is another character who seems sprung from a Buchan novel. The kind of the hint of tales of imperial derring do. So he is born in Madagascar. He's the son of missionaries. He goes to boarding school in England. He comes of age during the First World War. The day that he comes of age, he rushes off, enlists, serves very valiantly and well in the First World War, gets mentioned in dispatches, comes back, sets up his medical practice, and he is the person who produces this photo. And the Daily Mail get hold of it. They crop it to make it look as impressive as possible. They put it on the front page, and really that is the photograph that makes it not just a national talking point, but a global talking point. And basically everyone is obsessed by it, to the degree that even Nessie's MP runs into it. So Sir Murdoch MacDonald, who's the MP for Inverness-shire, and he's driving with his son early on the morning of the 8th of August, and he sees Nessie, his most famous constituent. And it's two blackish grey humps moving slowly south. And it's not just the MP who sees it. It's also seen, and I'm quoting here Gareth Williams, A Monstrous Commotion, his great book. says the sight was witnessed by a semi-naked Yorkshireman who sprang out of his caravan with binoculars and confirmed that it was neither a tree trunk nor a boat. The MP was on his way to see the Secretary of State for Scotland, who was happy to accept the monster as a reasonable excuse for starting their meeting late. So Frankie, you've had an MP, you've had a semi-naked Yorkshireman, you've had a veterinary student, yes, you've had a surgeon, you've had a water bailiff, you've had a gentleman's tailor.
Okay, these my skepticism is routed.
Of very, very respectable figures.
Although, so the surgeon's photograph, the photograph that we're all very familiar with, people have analysed it very closely, okay, haven't they? Well, they've discussed the ripples, they've discussed...
They have.
And am I right in thinking there is a twist with the surgeon's photograph?
There is a twist. Should we reveal the twist now, or should we say
well, it's
it?
Well, it's your choice. You're enjoying yourself far too much, so I'm going to let you decide.
Okay, so the twist is... that the surgeon, and this was discovered, I think, in the 90s, to everyone's huge disappointment, that it was a fake. And it was faked by our old friend Marmaduke Wetherill, who did it with an associate of Robert Wilson. And they went to a kind of, you know, a chalet part of the loch, and they made a model of it and they photographed it. And basically, if you look at the original photo before it got cropped by to go on the front page of the Mail, it looks much more like a fake than it does in the famous version of it.
And so they bought a toy submarine, hadn't they? And they made a sort of wooden...
A wooden thing to go on the top.
Yeah.
Basically, Wetherill did it to get his own back. But in a way, the laugh was on him because...
Right.
Everyone... Yeah.
I read
Everyone
this.
Took it so seriously.
He thought this... He would make fools of the Mail by getting them to print this story on the front page. But they did, and it was tremendously successful.
Massively boosted the circulation. Hurrah!
Yes. Yeah. As revenge goes, it wasn't very successful. Now, that's not a salamander.
It's not a salamander.
But that, of course, is the image that we now... So it's the dinosaur image, isn't it? And I suppose the 1930s, you know, is an age of tremendous scientific interest in dinosaurs, a popular interest. So you can see why it caught the public imagination.
But I think that... I mean, we talked about film and we talked about adventure stories where people go to remote areas of the world because basically there aren't any remote areas of the world anymore. And the most famous cinematic example of that is King Kong.
Yeah.
And King Kong comes out in London in spring 1933. And it comes out in, I think it reaches Inverness by the summer of 1933.
Oh, very good.
And in King Kong, I don't know if you remember it, there's a sequence where, so King Kong is, King Kong is the giant gorilla, gets brought back to New York and climbs the Empire State Building. Everyone knows that story. But on the island, King Kong lives there surrounded by dinosaurs. Mm. And the big game hunters who are going off to capture King Kong and get Fay Wray back from him, as part of this expedition, are shown crossing a swamp in which a long-necked dinosaur, so a sauropod, emerges. Sauropods were vegetarian, but herbivorous, but in this they're very carnivorous and ferocious. And they attack, they upend the boat, and then the monster chases the fleeing explorers through the jungle. And the profile of that monster in King Kong is very, very like a lot of the drawings, and then in due course the photograph, the surgeon's photograph that you get. And it's hard, I think, hard to think that it's not influencing it. Because the degree to which the monster comes to be described as a plesiosaur almost exactly maps onto the screening of King Kong.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure not deliberately, but it's just such a kind of dramatic image. And, you know, as you say, I think that it is a kind of an expression of, you know, a yearning for those tales of daring do in distant climes in a world where everything is closing in.
Well, you were talking about motoring, weren't you? So, I mean, the 30s is a golden age of motoring, people getting cars for the first time, new roads and so on.
Yeah, so the Wage Road has been given an upgrade as well.
So the Highlands have kind of been opened up to an extent to lots of visitors. So you've got a tourist industry that is taking off. But at the same time, I suppose there's also an anxiety that the world is becoming, you know, the anxiety that we're so familiar with today, that the world is becoming globalized and homogenized, and a yearning, therefore, for places to have this kind of romantic, epic grandeur and mystery and this sort of primitivism, I suppose. I mean, this is what the Scottish government's education materials that recently caused headlines in Britain about Loch Ness. This is what they point out, isn't it? This is what they say, that this is, that the Loch Ness monster is in a way, is part of the same kind of romanticization of Scotland as you get with kilts, tartan, Rob Roy, Braveheart. Do you not think, Tom, there's a bit of that about it?
It sort of locates
Scotland as a place where there are dinosaurs, in contrast to cosmopolitan, metropolitan, urban England.
Or the lowlands of Scotland, more pointedly, because it's absolutely a Scottish story. I mean, the Daily Mail comes crashing in from London as an outsider, but it's absolutely not an English invention. It's not an English projection. I saw Alex Massey, very distinguished journalist and columnist, tongue firmly in his cheek, was asking about this. It's the Loch Ness monster comes from Scottish traditions, and it's Scots who initially see it. And of course, Loch Ness monster has been a fundamental part of how Scotland marks itself to the world. It's a crucial part of the tourist infrastructure. It brings people to the Highlands. And that is something that starts right from the beginning, that you are having, so people are, huge, huge numbers descend on Loch Ness over 1933 and 34. There's this extraordinary story, I was tipped off about this by Neil Kay on the Discord, that Scotland's first football floodlights were taken away to be used to highlight the loch. So this had been put up by Caledonian FC in Inverness. And this was kind of very innovative. They were the first football club in the country to use floodlights in this way. And they'd used them for about 3 or 4 games. And then somebody bought them to put up on the shores of Loch Ness to kind of try and highlight the presence of the monster. And the poor club only got their floodlights back again in 1959, which is very sad.
But people throughout the post-war years, so by this point, the monster had, I guess, become embedded in the national imagination, in the world's imagination, become part of the tourist industry. But you do get quite distinguished people, don't you?
You do.
A man who was the curator of fishes at the Natural History Museum.
Well, one of the things that happens just before the world goes into war, and I think also one of the other reasons why it kicks off in 1933 and 34 is this: the Depression. It's coming to power of Hitler in Germany. It's a really dark time, and people want cheering up. And it's a kind of perfect story. And I think that it's a bit like the discovery of Tutankhamun. It's a good news story, and it's a quest. And I'm sure that the shadow of Tutankhamun, which again has this kind of interface with the press, quests, dramatic characters, kind of big game figures, all these kind of, you know, panoply of characters who you might recognize from a film. Very similar with Loch Ness, except with the convenience you don't have to go all the way to Egypt, you know. It's there in Britain. It's kind of waiting on your doorstep. But one of the things I think that does serve to elevate the whole narrative above a kind of King Kong level is in 1938, a fish called the coelacanth is discovered in waters off South Africa. And the coelacanth had been thought, you know, it's a very, very ancient fish. It had basically been around since, I think, 350 million years old, something like that, and was thought to have gone extinct with the dinosaurs because there was no fossil trace of it after that. And then it got discovered in 1938. And so suddenly the idea that creatures that had been thought extinct might not have gone extinct is scientifically reputable. And that is something that feeds through the war years, through the 40s into the 50s. And yes, and as you say, so in the 50s, the curator of fishes at the Natural History Museum, so he's a guy who's absolutely on top of the coelacanth and the implications of it. He's at Loch Ness. He sees a large humped object going through the water, and he's convinced it's a plesiosaur. And he rushes back and tells everyone. And the Natural History Museum are not amused, and he gets forced out.
Well, he presumably wanted to see it. Do you think, Tom? He wanted to see the monster.
Yeah, probably. But the person who really kind of kickstarts the whole obsession again in the 60s is this guy, Tim Dinsdale, who wrote the book that I mentioned at the start of the of this episode, he's an aeronautical engineer working at Heathrow. I mean, you know, the most unromantic location imaginable. Mm. And he's on holiday in the Highlands in spring 1960. And he sees Nessie and he's got a camera and he films it. And it's that footage that people can actually look at it. And this attracts the attention of a very, very distinguished figure, a man called Sir Peter Scott. And Dominic, you mentioned, you specified how the world is shrinking because people have been to the poles. And Peter Scott is the son of Scott of the Antarctic.
Yeah, and Robert Falcon Scott.
Yeah. And Scott of the Antarctic, in I think his last letter to his wife, just before he dies, Peter Scott is 2 years old at this point. He writes to his wife and says, please make sure that Peter grows up with a love of the natural world. And Peter does grow up with a love of the natural world. He becomes very, very distinguished. Initially, he's a sportsman. He shoots duck.
That shows a great love of the natural world.
But he then kind of turns and he becomes an ornithologist. He becomes a conservationist. He helps to set up the World Wildlife Fund.
I was about to say, as a boy, I went to his wildfowl place at Slimbridge. It was a great place for school outings in the 1970s and 1980s. And I imagine quite a few of our listeners will have been there and will know of him because of his role setting up the World Wildlife Fund.
But he's Scott's son, Scott of the Antarctic, and he is a kind of hangover again from that age of imperial derring-do. So he's a very distinguished war record. He is an Olympic athlete. So he wins bronze, I think, in the dinghy racing in the Berlin Olympics of 36. So that's the Hitler Olympics.
Yeah.
And the dinghy racing is held at Kiel. And he then goes back and bombs it with the RAF. So he's a very brave, kind of dashing man. He marries Elizabeth Jane Howard,
a novelist,
then goes on to marry Kingsley Amis, doesn't she? Become Martin Amis's stepmother. So very interesting man. And he meets up with Dinsdale, looks at the footage, and basically becomes obsessed. And he really wants the Loch Ness Monster to be real. And perhaps there's all kinds of stuff to do with his father. I don't know. Mm. I mean, maybe I'm over psychologizing it there, but perhaps, you know, he wants to find something that would, you know, be remarkable and extraordinary, a great quest as his father had gone on. And in the 70s, he and Dinsdale meet up with an American lawyer from Boston, a man called Robert Rhines, who in the early 70s starts using sonar to explore the lock. And in 1972, the sonar picks out a huge shape plus another photograph of what might, seen from a certain angle, look like a flipper.
Yes, I've seen those pictures. Of course, it might not be a flipper. That's the downside with that photo.
These get picked up by a man who anyone interested in royal affairs in Britain will be very, very familiar with, a man called Nicholas Witchell.
This is such a bizarre part of the
BBC royal correspondent. Yeah. But back in the early 70s, he was a student, and he becomes a massive, massive kind of Nessie twitcher, and he writes a book about it. And so Scott and Dinsdale read Nicholas Witchell's book, and they get in touch with Robert Rhines, and you know, they all team up. And in 75, Rhines takes another extraordinary photo, which again, if you know anything about the Western Monster, you'll recognize. It's a kind of yellowish photo, and it seems to show a head on a long neck attached to a kind of body. Again, it requires a certain leap of faith, but once you've seen it, you know, if you're looking for it, that's what you see. And this encourages Scott to propose that the Loch Ness Monster actually exists. And he comes up with a scientific name for it. And he wants to use the Loch Ness Monster as an icon for conservation. So in other words, if there is this prehistoric creature that is in the loch, then it shows it reveals the wonders of the natural world in a way that would enable the monster to serve as an absolute kind of ambassador for global conservation. So that's what he's interested in. He summons people from across the scientific natural the world of natural history, and makes his case. And the response of the former chairman of the Natural History Museum's trustees is to say, we cannot do this without a specimen. You know, we need a physical specimen. And without that, the chairman says, the monster not merely beggars description, but buggers it. And the response of David Attenborough, who is a good friend of Peter Scott, keen conservationist, Scott would like Attenborough on board. David Attenborough's response is to say, well, it's very courageous.
Oh, David Attenborough was very tactful, isn't he?
Paleontologists say we can't do anything about this without bones. And basically, people don't accept that Peter Scott has a leg to stand on with this. And
cool flipper.
For Peter Scott's reputation, I think it's a bit like Hugh Trevor Roper and the Hitler Diaries. It's a man with an incredibly distinguished reputation, using that reputation to try and convince people that something so extraordinary as to seem incredible actually is true, but it does turn out to be incredible. And it kind of really damages Scott's reputation in the way that Hugh Trevor Roper's reputation was damaged by his authenticating the Hitler Diaries.
So what's interesting about this, Tom, is that the story of the Loch Ness Monster as a historical phenomenon turns out not to be really a story about the Loch Ness Monster so much as it's a story about, well, it is a story about Scotland and its place in the imagination as a sort of wild, as the Highlands as a kind of wild part of the United Kingdom. But it's also really, am I pushing it too far to say it's a story about the aftermath of the Victorian kind of, in inverted commas, conquest of the natural world and of imperialism?
Yeah.
And what do the next generation do? What do you know, people like, what's his name? Marmaduke Wetherill or whatever his name is.
Or
Peter Scott, people who are living in the shadow
of the generation. And the Duke of Edinburgh as well. I mean, it's all that kind of, it's that class of person who are coming of age in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, who have been raised by the traditions and the stories told of the British Empire to assume that their destiny is to go out and discover, you know, distant lands, strange valleys, rocky plateaus with dinosaurs on them, all that kind of stuff. That kind of, that mythology of imperialism. And it's all gone. And in a way, the Loch Ness Monster is a kind of a ghostly after echo of that. And I think that's why you get all these kind of figures, Marmaduke Wetherill, Peter Scott, who are almost like figures out of time.
Yeah.
But I think it's not just about imperialism. I think it is also about a growing anxiety about the depletion of the natural world, about the collapse of biodiversity. I mean, people wouldn't have put it like that in the 50s. But Peter Scott was an absolutely committed conservationist, and I think that he was onto something with this idea that the Loch Ness Monster might be an icon, because in a way, our yearning to believe that the Loch Ness Monster exists, our yearning to believe that a plesiosaur might have survived extinction, is expressive of our longing to believe that, you know, huge numbers of species can survive extinction.
Yeah.
You know, it's, there are more recent creatures where, you know, so the thylacine, which is a marsupial creature in Tasmania that was wiped out, people again and again and again report seeing it in Tasmania. It always turns out not to be the case. But it kind of speaks almost of a kind of guilt, I think.
Yeah, and it's interesting that the Loch Ness Monster coincides within 20 or 30 years with both Yeti and Bigfoot. So Bigfoot in America. So as you said, it's the Pacific Northwest. I think it's really a 1950s, 60s kind of phenomenon. And again, I wonder if it's the same. You know, the United States is being opened up by Eisenhower's, you know, highways, by air travel and so on. And people want to believe that there's a bit of the wilderness left. And whether that's guilt or whether it's romanticism or exoticism, I mean, who can say? You don't believe in the Loch Ness Monster, Tom? What a shame.
Well,
what a disappointment.
Well, I think it's conclusively been proved not to exist, because what's happened, of course, in recent years is that you've got DNA that basically torpedoes all kinds of fantasies and dreams. And they did a study of the DNA in Loch Ness, and there is nothing unusual at all in the genetic material. Right. So, you know, if there was a Loch Ness monster, it's not there now.
So says so that's very top, sad. Top party pooper, Tom Holland. Yeah.
But just you know, we talked about the Scottish tourist industry. Just one shout out for the Scottish tourist industry. Because have you been to Loch Ness?
I've never been to Loch Ness, Tom.
Okay, well, it's great. I mean, it's really worth it. If you've had any interest in Loch Ness Monster, to go there, to look at the castle, to start, you know, it's all very familiar. But they have a magnificent a museum devoted to it. And you go around all this museum, and the final room, it's saying, what was it? And I was fully expecting them to say it was a plesiosaur or something, or we don't know. And they say it was a sturgeon. I thought that's really admirable that you've got this massive cash cow that tourists come all over the world for. You basically say you've been, you know, no, it doesn't exist. So kudos to whoever runs that museum.
Okay. I think we've put that one to bed, as were, don't you, Tom?
That we have, yeah.
And on that bombshell, we will say goodbye, and we will see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.